gently to make the dark curly hairs twitch and rise. The other was under the pillow. If she moved her finger slightly, she could feel the smooth little shape of the ancient wifey, as he called it. She could imagine her own womb swelling, round and hard. She could feel the clutch and soft spasm in her lower belly, aftershocks of their lovemaking. Would it be this time? He turned his head on the pillow, thinking. Long lashes lay against his cheek, black as the lines of the trees outside. He turned back then, lifting them, and his eyes were the colour of moss, soft and vivid in the shadowed light.
"I could be romantic," he whispered,
and his fingers drifted down her back so that she felt gooseflesh rise in their wake.
"I could say, this is my dream. You and me, here alone. Us and our children."
He turned his head a little, checking the trundle in the corner, but Jemmy was sound asleep, invisible.
"You could," she echoed,
and ducked her head so her forehead pressed against his shoulder.
"But that's a waking dream, not a real dream. You know what I mean."
"Aye, I do."
He was quiet for a minute, his hand lying still, broad and warm across the base of her spine.
"Sometimes," he whispered at last, "sometimes I dream I'm singing, and I wake from it with my throat aching."
He couldn't see her face or the tears that prickled at the corners of her eyes.
"What do you sing?" she whispered back.
She heard the shush of the linen pillow as he shook his head.
"No song I've ever heard or know," he said softly. "But I know I'm singing it for you."
Chapter 106. The Surgeon's Book 2. July 27th, 1772. Was called from Churning to attend Rosamond Lindsay, who arrived in late afternoon with a severe laceration to the left hand, sustained with an axe while girdling trees. Wound was extensive, having nearly severed the left thumb. Laceration extended from base of index finger to 2 inches above the styloid process of the radius, which was superficially damaged. Injury had been sustained approximately 3 days prior, treated with rough binding and bacon grease. Extensive sepsis apparent, with suppuration, gross swelling of hand and forearm. Thumb blackened, gangrene apparent, characteristic pungent odour. Subcutaneous red streaks, indicative of blood poisoning, extended from site of injury nearly to antecubital fossa. Patient presented with high fever, estimated 104 degrees Fahrenheit by hand. Symptoms of dehydration, mild disorientation, tachycardia evident. In view of the seriousness of patient's condition, recommended immediate amputation of limb at elbow. Patient refused to consider this, insisting instead upon application of pigeon poultice, consisting of the split body of a freshly killed pigeon applied to wound. Patient's husband had brought pigeon, neck freshly wrung. Removed thumb at base of metacarpal, ligated remains of radial artery, crushed in original injury, and superficialis voli. Debrided and drained wound, applied approximately 1/2 ounce crude penicillin powder. Source, rotted cassava rind, batch number 23, prepared April 15, 1771, topically. Followed by application of mashed raw garlic, 3 cloves, barberry salve, and pigeon poultice, at insistence of husband, applied over dressing. Administered fluids by mouth. Febrifuge mixture of red centaury, bloodroot, and hops. Water ad lib. Injected liquid penicillin mixture, batch number 23. 4. Dosage 1/4 ounce in suspension in sterile water. Patient's condition deteriorated rapidly with increasing symptoms of disorientation and delirium, high fever. Extensive urticaria appeared on arm and upper torso. Attempted to relieve fever by repeated applications of cold water, to no avail. Patient being incoherent, requested permission to amputate from husband. permission denied on grounds that death appeared imminent and patient would not want to be buried in pieces. Repeated penicillin injection. Patient lapsed into unconsciousness shortly thereafter and expired just before dawn. I dipped my quill again, but then hesitated, letting the drops of ink slide off the sharpened point. How much more should I say? The deeply ingrained disposition for scientific thoroughness warred with caution. It was important to describe what had happened as fully as possible. At the same time, I hesitated to put down in writing what might amount to an admission of manslaughter. It wasn't murder, I assured myself, though my guilty feelings made no such distinctions. Feelings aren't truth, I murmured. Across the room, Brianna looked up from the bread she was slicing, but I bent my head over the page, and she returned to her whispered conversation with Masali by the fire. It was no more than mid-afternoon, but dark and rainy outside. I had lit a candle by which to write, but the girl's hands flickered over the dim table like moths, lighting here and there among the plates and platters. The truth was that I didn't think Rosamond Lindsay had died of septicemia. I was fairly sure that she had died of an acute reaction to an unpurified penicillin mixture, of the medicine I gave her, in short. Of course, the truth also was that the blood poisoning would certainly have killed her, left untreated. The truth also was that I had had no way of knowing what the effects of the penicillin would be. But that was rather the point, wasn't it? To make sure someone else might know. I twiddled the quill, rolling it between thumb and forefinger. I had kept a faithful account of my experiments with penicillin, the growing of cultures on media ranging from bread to chewed pawpaw and rotted melon rind, painstaking descriptions of the microscopic and gross identification of the penicillium moulds, the effects of, to this point, very limited applications. Yes, certainly I must include a description of the effects. The real question, though, was, for whom was I keeping this careful record? I bit my lip, thinking. If it was only for my own reference, it would be a simple matter. I could simply record the symptoms, timing, and effects without explicitly noting the cause of death. I was unlikely to forget the circumstances, after all. But if this record were ever to be useful to someone else, someone who had no notion of the benefits and dangers of an antibiotic. The ink was drying on the quill. I lowered the point to the page. Age 44, I wrote slowly. In this day, casebook accounts like this often ended with a pious description of the deceased's last moments, marked, presumably, by Christian resignation on the part of the holy, repentance by the sinful. Neither attitude had marked the passage of Rosamond Lindsay. I glanced at the coffin, sitting on its trestles under the rain-smeared window. The Lindsay's cabin was very small, not suited for a funeral in the pouring rain, where a large number of mourners were expected. The coffin was open, awaiting the evening wake, but the muslin shroud had been drawn up over her face. Rosamond had been a whore in Boston, growing too stout and too old to ply her trade with much profit. She had drifted south, looking for a husband. "I couldn't bide another of them winters," she had confided to me soon after her arrival on the ridge, "nor yet another of them stinking fishermen." She had found the necessary refuge in Kenneth Lindsay, who was looking for a wife to share the work of homesteading. Not a match born of physical attraction. The Lindsays had had perhaps 6 sound teeth between them, or emotional compatibility. Still, it had seemed an amicable relationship. Shocked rather than grief-stricken, Kenny had been taken off by Jamie for medication with whiskey, a somewhat more effective treatment than my own. At least, I didn't think it would be lethal. "Immediate cause of death," I wrote, and paused again. I doubted that Rosamond's response to approaching death would have found outlet in either prayer or philosophy, but she had had opportunity for neither. She had died, blue-faced, congested, and bulging-eyed, unable to force word or breath past the swollen tissues of her throat. My own throat felt tight at the memory, as though I were being choked. I picked up the cooling cup of cat-mint tea and took a sip, feeling the pungent liquid slide soothingly down. It was little comfort that the septicemia would have killed her more lingeringly. Suffocation was quicker, but not much more pleasant. I tapped the quill point on the blotter, leaving inky pinpoints that spread through the rough fibres of the paper, forming a galaxy of tiny stars. As to that, there was another possibility. Death might conceivably have been due to a pulmonary embolism, a clot in the lung. That would be a not impossible complication of the septicemia and could have accounted for the symptoms. It was a hopeful thought, but not one I placed much credence in. It was the voice of experience, as much as the voice of conscience, that bade me dip the quill and write down anaphylaxis before I could think again. Was anaphylaxis a known medical term yet? I hadn't seen it in any of Rawling's notes, but then I hadn't read them all. Still, while death from the shock of allergic reaction wasn't unknown in any time, it wasn't common and might not be known by name. Better describe it in detail for whoever might read this. And that was the rub, of course. Who would read it? I thought it unlikely, but what if a stranger should read this and take my account for a confession of murder? That was far-fetched, but it could happen. I had come perilously close to being executed as a witch, in part because of my healing activities. Once almost burned, twice shy, I thought wryly. Extensive swelling in affected limb, I wrote, and lifted the quill, the last word fading as the pen ran dry. I dipped it again and scratched doggedly on. Swelling extended to upper torso, face and neck. Skin pale, marked with reddish blotches. Respiration increasingly rapid and shallow. Heartbeat very fast and light, tending to inaudibility. Palpitations evident. Lips and ears cyanotic. Pronounced exophthalmia. I swallowed again at the thought of Rosamond's eyes bulging under the lids, rolling to and fro in uncomprehending terror. We had tried to shut them when we cleansed the body and laid it out for burial. It was customary to uncover the corpse's face for the wake. I thought it unwise in this case. I didn't want to look at the coffin again, but did, with a small nod of acknowledgement and apology. Brianna's head turned toward me, then sharply away. The smell of the food laid out for the wake was filling the room, mingling with the scents of oak wood fire and oak gall ink, and the fresh planed oak of the coffin's boards. I took another hasty gulp of tea to stop my gorge rising. I knew damn well why the first line of Hippocrates' oath was, "First, do no harm." It was too bloody easy to do harm. What hubris it took to lay hands on a person, to interfere. How delicate and complex were bodies. How crude a physician's intrusions. I could have sought seclusion in surgery or study to write these notes. I knew why I hadn't. The coarse muslin shroud glowed soft white in the rainy light from the window. I pinched the quill hard between thumb and forefinger, trying to forget the pop of the cricoid cartilage when I had jabbed a penknife into Rosamond's throat in a final futile attempt to let air into her straining lungs. And yet, there was not one practicing physician, I thought, who had never faced this. I had had it happen a few times before, even in a modern hospital equipped with every life-saving device known to man. Then, some future physician here would face the same dilemma. To undertake a possibly dangerous treatment, or to allow a patient to die who might have been saved. And that was my own dilemma, to balance the unlikely possibility of prosecution for manslaughter against the unknown value of my records to someone who might seek knowledge in them. Who might that be? I wiped the pen, thinking. There were as yet few medical schools, and those few mostly in Europe. Most physicians gain their knowledge from apprenticeship and experience. I slipped a finger into the casebook, feeling blind between the early pages kept by the book's original owner. Rawlings hadn't gone to a medical school, though if he had, many of his techniques would still have been shocking by my standards. My mouth twisted at the thought of some of the treatments I had seen described in those closely written pages. Infusions of liquid mercury to cure syphilis. cupping and blistering for epileptic fits, lancing and bleeding for every disorder from indigestion to impotence. And still, Daniel Rawlings had been a doctor. Reading his case notes, I could feel his care for his patients, his curiosity regarding the mysteries of the body. Moved by impulse, I turned back to the pages containing Rawlings' notes. Perhaps I was only delaying to let my subconscious reach a decision, or perhaps I felt the need of communication, no matter how remote, with another physician, someone like me. Someone like me. I stared at the page with its neat small writing, its careful illustration, seeing none of the details. Who was there, like me? No one. I had thought of it before, but only vaguely, in the way of a problem acknowledged, but so distant as not to require any urgency. In the colony of North Carolina, so far as I knew, there was only one formally designated doctor. Fentiman. I snorted and took another sip of tea. Better Murray MacLeod and his nostrums. Most of those were harmless, at least. I sipped my tea, regarding Rosamond. The simple truth was that I wouldn't last forever, either. With luck, a good long time yet, but still, not forever. I needed to find someone to whom I could pass on at least the rudiments of what I knew. A stifled giggle from the table, the girls whispering over the pots of head cheese, the bowls of sauerkraut and boiled potatoes. No, I thought with some regret. Not Brianna. She would be the logical choice. She knew what modern medicine was, at least. There would be no overcoming of ignorance and superstition. No need to convince of the virtues of asepsis, the dangers of germs. But she had no natural inclination, no instinct for healing. She wasn't squeamish or afraid of blood. She had helped me with any number of childbirths and minor surgical procedures. And yet she lacked that peculiar mixture of empathy and ruthlessness a doctor needs. She was perhaps Jamie's child more than mine, I reflected, watching the firelight ripple in the folds of her hair as she moved. She had his courage, his great tenderness. But it was the courage of a warrior, the tenderness of a strength that could crush if it chose. I hadn't managed to give her my gift, the knowledge of blood and bone, the secret ways of the chambers of the heart. Brianna's head lifted sharply, turning toward the door. Massali, slower, turned too, listening. It was barely audible through the thrumming of the rain, but knowing it was there, I could pick it out. A male voice, raised high, chanting. A pause, and then a faint answering rumble that might have been distant thunder, but wasn't. The men were coming down from the shelter on the mountain. Kenny Lindsay had asked Roger to chant the Kairush for Rosamond, the formal Gaelic lament for the dead. "She wasn't a Scots," Kenny had said, wiping eyes bleared from tears and a long night's watching. "Not even God-fearing. But she was that fond of singing, and she fair admired your way of it, Mackenzie." Roger had never done a Kairush before. I knew he had never heard one. "Dinna fash," Jamie had murmured to him, hand on his arm. "All you need to be is loud." Roger had bent his head gravely in acquiescence and went with Jamie and Kenneth to drink whiskey by the malting floor and learn what he could of Rosamond's life, the better to lament her passing. The hoarse chant vanished. The wind had shifted. It was a freak of the storm that we had heard them so soon. They would be headed down the ridge now to collect mourners from the outlying cabins and then to lead them all in procession back up to the house for the feasting and singing and storytelling that would go on all night. I yawned involuntarily, my jaw cracking at the thought of it. I'd never last, I thought in dismay. I had had a few hours' sleep in the morning, but not enough to sustain me through a full-blown Gaelic wake and funeral. The floors would be thick with bodies by dawn, all of them smelling of whiskey and wet clothes. I yawned again, then blinked, my eyes swimming as I shook my head to clear it. Every bone in my body ached with fatigue, and I wanted nothing more than to go to bed for several days. Deep in thought, I hadn't noticed Brianna coming to stand behind me. Her hands came down on my shoulders, and she moved closer, so I felt the warmth of her touching me. Masali had gone. We were alone. She began to massage my shoulders, long thumbs moving slowly up the cords of my neck.
"Tired?" she asked.
"Hmm.
I'll do," I said.
I closed the book and leaned back, relaxing momentarily in the sheer relief of her touch. I hadn't realized I was strung so tightly.
The big room was quiet and orderly, ready for the wake. Mrs. Bug was tending the barbecue. The girls had lit a pair of candles, one at each end of the laden table, and shadows flickered over the whitewashed walls, the quiet coffin, as the candle flames bent in a sudden draught.
"I think I killed her," I said suddenly, not meaning to say it at all. "It was the penicillin that killed her."
The long fingers didn't stop their soothing movement.
"Was it?" she murmured.
"You couldn't have done any differently, though, could you?"
"No."
A small shudder of relief went over me, as much from the bald confession as from the gradual release of the painful tightness in my neck and shoulders.
"It's okay," she said softly, rubbing, stroking. "She would have died anyway, wouldn't she? It's sad, but you didn't do wrong. You know that."
"I know that." To my surprise, a single tear slid down my cheek and dropped on the page, puckering the paper. I blinked hard, struggling for control. I didn't want to distress Brianna. She wasn't distressed. Her hands left my shoulders, and I heard the scraping of stool legs. Then her arms came around me, and I let her draw me back, my head resting just under her chin. She simply held me, letting the rise and fall of her breathing calm me.
"I went to dinner with Uncle Joe once, just after he'd lost a patient," she said finally. "He told me about it."
"Did he?" I was a little surprised. I wouldn't have thought Joe would talk about such things with her.
"He didn't mean to." I could see something was bothering him, though, so I asked. "And he needed to talk, and I was there. Afterward, he said it was almost like having you there."
"I didn't know he called you Lady Jane."
"Yes," I said. "Because of the way I talk," he said.
I felt a breath of laughter against my ear and smiled slightly in response. I closed my eyes and could see my friend gesturing in passionate conversation, face alight with the desire to tease.
"He said that when something like that happened, sometimes there would be a sort of formal inquiry at the hospital. Not like a trial, not that. But a gathering of the other doctors to hear exactly what happened, what went wrong. He said it was sort of like confession to tell it to other doctors who could understand, and it helped."
"Mm-hmm." She was swaying slightly, rocking me as she moved, as she rocked Jemmy, soothing.
"Is that what's bothering you?" she asked quietly. "Not just Rosamond, but that you're alone? You don't have anybody who can really understand?"
Her arms wrapped around my shoulders, her hands crossed, resting lightly on my chest. Young, broad, capable hands, the skin fresh and fair, smelling of fresh-baked bread and strawberry jam. I lifted one and laid the warm palm against my cheek.
"Apparently I do," I said.
The hand curved, stroked my cheek, and dropped away. The big young hand moved slowly, smoothing the hair behind my ear with soft affection.
"It'll be all right," she said. "Everything will be all right."
"Yes," I said, and smiled, despite the tears blurring my eyes. I couldn't teach her to be a doctor, but evidently I had, without meaning to, somehow taught her to be a mother.
"You should go lie down," she said, taking her hands away reluctantly. "It will be an hour at least before they get here."
I let my breath go out in a sigh, feeling the peace of the house around me.
If Fraser's Ridge had been a short-lived haven for Rosamund Lindsay, still, it had been a true home. We would see her safe and honoured in death.
"In a minute," I said, wiping my nose. "I need to finish something first."
I sat up straight and opened my book. I dipped my pen and began to write the lines that must be there for the sake of the unknown physician who would follow me.
Chapter 107. Zukan Ruha.
September 1772. I woke drenched in sweat. The thin chemise in which I slept clung to me, transparent with wet. The darkness of my flesh showed in patches through the cloth, even in the dim light from the unshuttered window. I had kicked away sheet and quilt in my disordered sleep, and lay sprawled with the linen shift rucked up above my thighs. But still my skin pulsed with heat, waves of smothering warmth that flowed over me like melted candle wax. I swung my legs over the side of the bed and stood up, feeling dizzy and disembodied. My hair was soaked, and my neck was slick with perspiration. A trickle of sweat ran down between my breasts and disappeared. Jamie was still asleep. I could see the humped mound of his upturned shoulder and the spill of his hair dark across the pillow. He shifted slightly and mumbled something, but then lapsed into the regular deep breaths of sleep. I needed air, but didn't want to wake him. I pushed away the gauze netting, stepped softly across to the door and into the small box room across the hall. It was a small room, but it had a large window in order to balance the one in our bedroom. This one had no glass as yet. It was covered only by wooden shutters, and I could feel draughts of night air drifting through the slats, swirling across the floor, caressing my bare legs. Urgent for the coolness of it, I stripped off my wet shift and sighed in relief as the draught skimmed upward over hips and breasts and arms. The heat was still there, though, hot waves pulsing over my skin with each heartbeat. Fumbling in the dark, I unfastened the shutters and pushed them open, gasping for the great draughts of cool night that flooded in upon me. From here I could see above the trees that screened the house, down the slope of the ridge, almost to the faint black line of the river far away. The wind stirred in the treetops, murmuring, and wafted over me with blessed coolness and the pungent green smell of leaves and summer sap. I closed my eyes and stood still. Within a minute or two, the heat was gone, vanished like a quenched coal, leaving me damp but peaceful. I didn't want to go back to bed yet. My hair was damp, and the sheets where I had lain would still be clammy. I leaned naked on the sill, the down hairs of my body prickling pleasantly as my skin cooled. The peaceful whooshing of the trees was interrupted by the thin sound of a child's wail, and I glanced toward the cabin. It was 100 yards from the house. The wind must be toward me to have carried the sound. Sure enough, the wind changed as I leaned out of the window, and the crying was lost in the flutter of leaves. The breeze passed on, though, and I could hear the screeching, louder now, in the silence. It was louder because it was getting closer. There was a creak and the groan of wood as the cabin door opened and someone stepped out. There was no lamp or candle lit in the cabin, and the quick glimpse I had of the emerging figure showed me nothing but a tall form silhouetted against the dim glow of the banked hearth inside. It seemed to have long hair, but both Roger and Brianna slept with their hair untied and capless. It was pleasant to imagine Roger's glossy black locks mingling with the fire of Brianna's on the pillow. Did they share a pillow? I wondered suddenly. The screeching hadn't abated. Fretful and cranky, but not agonized. Not bellyache. A bad dream? I waited a moment, watching to see whether whoever it was would bring the child to the house in search of me and put out a hand to my crumpled shift just in case. No. The tall figure had vanished into the spruce grove. I could hear the receding wails. Not fever, then. I realised that my breasts had begun to tingle and stiffen in response to the crying, and smiled a little ruefully. Strange, that instinct went so deep and lasted so long.
Would I come one day to a point when nothing in me stirred to the sound of a crying baby, to the scent of a man aroused, to the brush of my own long hair against the skin of my naked back? And if I did come to such a point, would I mourn the loss, I wondered, or find myself peaceful, left to contemplate existence without the intrusion of such animal sensations? It wasn't only the glories of the flesh that were the gifts of the world, after all. A doctor sees the plentiful miseries flesh is heir to as well. And yet, standing cool in the flood of late summer's air from the window, the boards smooth under my bare feet, and the touch of wind on bare skin, I couldn't wish to be a pure spirit. Not yet. The crying grew louder, and I heard the low murmur of an adult's voice below it, trying unsuccessfully to soothe it. Roger, then. I cupped my breasts gently, liking the soft, full weight of them. I remembered what they'd been like when I was very young. Small, hard swellings, so sensitive that the touch of a boy's hand made me weak in the knees. The touch of my own hand come to that. They were different now, and yet peculiarly the same. This was not the discovery of a new and unimagined thing, but rather only a new awareness, the acknowledgement of something that had risen while my back was turned. Like a shadow cast upon the wall, its presence unsuspected, seen only when I turned to look at it. But there, all the time. Oh, I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. And if I turned my back again, the shadow wouldn't leave me. It was irrevocably attached to me, whether I chose to notice it or not, crouched always, insubstantial, intangible, but present, small to vanishing under my feet when the light of other preoccupations shone upon me, blown up to gigantic proportions in the glare of some sudden urge. Resident demon? Or guardian angel? Or only the shadow of the beast, constant reminder of the inescapability of the body and its hungers? Another noise mingled with the whinging below. Coughing, I thought. But it didn't stop, and the rhythm sounded wrong. I put my head out, cautious as a snail after a thunderstorm, and made out a few words in the rasping gurgle.
Excavating for a mine, 49er, daughter Clementine.
Roger was singing. I felt the tears sting my eyes and drew my head in hastily, lest I be seen. There was no tune to it. The pitch varied no more than the hooting of wind across the mouth of an empty bottle. And yet it was music. A dogged, ragged gasp of a song. And yet Jemmy's wailing quieted to sniffling sobs, as though he was trying to make out the words so painfully forced through his father's scarred throat.
Fed she ducklings by the water.
He was having to gasp for breath after each whispered phrase, the sound of it like tearing linen. I curled my fingers into fists as though by sheer force of will I could help him get the words out.
Herring boxes without topses. Sandals were for Clementine.
The breeze was rising again, stirring in the tops of the trees. The next line was lost in their rustle, and I heard no more for a minute or two, strain my ears as I would. Then I saw Jamie, standing still. He made no noise, but I felt him at once, a warmth, a thickening in the cool air of the room.
"Are you well, Sassenach?" he asked softly from the doorway.
"Yes, fine." I spoke in a whisper, not to wake Lizzie and her father, who slept in the back bedroom. Just needed a breath of air. I didn't mean to wake you. He came closer, a tall, naked ghost, smelling of sleep.
I always wake when you do, Sassenach. I sleep ill without you by my side.
He touched my forehead briefly.
I thought you were maybe fevered. The bed was damp where you'd lain. You sure you're all right?
I was hot. I couldn't sleep. But yes, I'm all right. And you?
I touched his face. His skin was warm with sleep.
He came to stand beside me at the window, looking out into the late summer night. The moon was full, and the birds were restless. From near at hand I heard the faint chirp of a late-nesting warbler, and farther off the squeak of a hunting, saw-wet owl.
"You recall Lawrence Sterne?" Jamie asked, evidently reminded of the naturalist by the sounds.
"I doubt anyone who's met him would forget him," I said dryly. "The bag of dried spiders makes rather an impression, to say nothing of the smell."
Sterne carried with him a distinctive aroma, composed in equal parts of natural body odour, an expensive cologne that he favoured, which was sufficiently strong to compete with, though not to conquer, the pungencies of various preservatives, such as camphor and alcohol, and a faint reek of decay from the specimens he collected. He chuckled softly.
"That's true. He stinks worse than you do."
"I do not stink," I said indignantly.
"Mm-hmm."
He took my hand and lifted it to his nose, sniffing delicately.
"Onions," he said, "and garlic. Something hot. Peppercorns. Aye, and clove. Squirrel blood and meat juice."
His tongue flicked out like a snake's, touching my knuckles.
"Starch, potatoes, and something woody. Toadstools."
"Not fair at all," I said, trying to get my hand back. "You know perfectly well what we had for dinner. And they weren't toadstools. They were wood ears."
"Hmm?"
He turned my hand over and sniffed at my palm, then my wrist, and up my forearm.
"Vinegar and dill. You've been making cucumber pickles, aye? Good. I like those. Hmm. Oh, and soured milk here in the fine hairs on your arm. Were you splashed churning butter or skimming cream?"
"You guess, since you're so good at it."
"Butter. Damn."
I was still trying to pull away, but only because the stubble on his face tickled the sensitive skin of my upper arm. He smelled his way up my arm into the hollow of my shoulder, making me squeak as the strands of his hair drifted across my skin. He lifted my arm a bit, touched the damp silky hair there, and ran his fingers under his nose.
"Eau de femme,"
he murmured, and I heard the laughter in his voice.
"Ma petite fleur."
"And I bathed too," I said ruefully.
"Aye, with the sunflower soup," he said,
a slight tone of surprise in his voice as he sniffed at the hollow of my collarbone. I gave a small, high-pitched yelp, and he reached up to lay a large, warm hand across my mouth.
He smelled of gunpowder, hay, and manure, but I couldn't say so, what with him muffling me.
He straightened a bit, and leaned close, so the roughness of his whiskers brushed my cheek. His hand fell away, and I felt the softness of his lips against my temple, the butterfly touch of his tongue on my skin.
"And salt,"
he said very softly, his breath warm on my face.
"There is salt on your face, and your lashes are wet. Do you weep, Sassenach?"
"No," I said, though I had a sudden irrational urge to do just that. "No. I sweat. I was hot." I wasn't any longer. My skin was cool, cold where the night draught from the window chilled my backside.
"Ah, but here. Mmm."
He was on his knees now, one arm about my waist to hold me still, his nose buried in the hollow between my breasts.
"Oh," he said,
and his voice had changed again. I didn't normally wear perfume, but I had a special oil sent from the Indies, made with orange flowers, jasmine, vanilla beans, and cinnamon. I had only a tiny vial and wore a small dab infrequently, for occasions that I thought might perhaps be special.
"You wanted me," he said ruefully, "and I fell asleep without even touching you. I'm sorry, Sassenach, you should have said."
"You were tired." His hand had left my mouth. I stroked his hair, smoothing the long dark strands behind his ear. He laughed, and I felt the warmth of his breath on my bare stomach.
You could raise me from the dead for that, Sassenach, and I wouldn't have minded.
He stood up then, facing me, and even in the dim light I could see that no such desperate measures on my part would be required. It's hot, I said. I'm sweating.
You think I'm not?
His hands closed on my waist, and he lifted me suddenly, setting me down on the broad windowsill. I gasped at contact with the cool wood, reflexively grasping the window frame on either side.
What on earth are you doing?
He didn't bother answering. It was an entirely rhetorical question in any case. Eau de femme, he murmured, his soft hair brushing across my thighs as he knelt.
The floorboards creaked under his weight.
Parfum d'amour, hm?
The cool breeze lifted my hair, drew it tickling across my back like the lightest of lover's touches. Jamie's hands were firm on the curve of my hips. I was in no danger of falling, and yet I felt the dizzy drop behind me, the clear and endless night with its star-strewn empty sky into which I might fall and go on falling, a tiny speck blazing hotter and hotter with the friction of my passage, bursting finally into the incandescence of a shooting star.
"Shh," Jamie murmured, far off.
He was standing now, his hands on my waist,
and the moaning noise might have been the wind or me.
His fingers brushed my lips. They might have been matches striking flames against my skin. Heat danced over me, belly and breast, neck and face, burning in front, cool behind,
like St. Lawrence on his gridiron.
I wrapped my legs around him, one heel settled in the cleft of his buttocks, the solid strength of his hips between my legs, my only anchor.
"Let go," he said in my ear. "I'll hold you." I did let go, and leaned back on the air, safe in his hands.
"You did start out to tell me something about Lawrence Stern," I murmured drowsily, much later.
"So I did."
Jamie stretched and settled himself, a hand curved proprietorially over my buttock. My knuckles brushed the hairs on his thigh. It was too hot to lie pressed together, but we didn't want to separate entirely.
"We were talking of birds, he being uncommon fond of them. I asked him why it was that in the late summer the birds sing at night. The nights are shorter then. You'd think they'd want their rest, but no. There's rustling and twittering and all manner of carryings on all the night long in the hedges and the trees."
"Are there? I hadn't noticed."
"You'd know in the habit of sleeping in the forest, Sassenach," he said tolerantly. "I have been, and so had Stern. He'd noticed the same thing, he said, and wondered why."
"And did he have an answer?"
"Not an answer, but a theory at least."
"Oh, even better," I said in sleepy amusement.
He gave a soft grunt of agreement and rolled slightly to one side, admitting a little welcome air between our salty skins. I could see the gleam of moisture over the slope of his shoulder and the prickle of sweat among the dark curly hairs of his chest. He scratched gently at it with a softly agreeable rasping sound.
"What he did was to capture a number of the birds and shut them up in cages lined with blotting paper."
"What?"
That waked me up a bit, if only to laugh.
"Whatever for?"
"Well, not lined entirely, only on the floor," he explained. "He put out a wee plate on the floor, filled with ink, and a cup of seed in the middle, so that they couldn't feed without getting the ink on their feet. Then, as they hopped to and fro, their footprints would show on the blotting paper."
"Hmm. And what precisely did that show, other than black footprints?"
The insects were beginning to find us, drawn by the musk of our heated flesh. A tiny zee by my ear prompted me to slap at the invisible mosquito, then reach for the gauze cloth that Jamie had pushed back when he rose to find me. This was fastened to an ingenious mechanism, Brianna's invention, fixed to the beam above the bed, so that when unrolled, the cloth fell down on all sides, shielding us from the bloodthirsty hordes of the summer nights. I pulled it into place with some regret, for while it excluded mosquitoes, gnats, and the unnervingly large mosquito hawk moths, it also unavoidably shut out some of the air and all sight of the luminous night sky beyond the window. I lay down again at a little distance on the bed. While Jamie's natural furnace was a great boon on winter nights, it had its drawbacks in the summer. I didn't mind melting in an inferno of blazing desire if it came to that, but I had no more clean shifts. There were a great many footprints, Sassenach, but most of them were on one side of the cage, in all the cages.
Oh, really? And what did Stern think that signified?
Well, he had the bright idea of putting down a compass by the cages, and it seems that all the night through the birds were hopping and striving toward the southeast, which is the direction in which they migrate come the fall.
That's very interesting. I pulled my hair back into a tail, lifting it off my neck for coolness. But it's not quite the time to migrate, is it, in late summer? And they don't fly at night, do they, even when they migrate?
No, it was as though they felt the imminence of flight and the pull of it, and that disturbed their rest. The stranger it was, because most of the birds that he had were young ones who had never yet made the journey. They hadn't seen the place where they were bound, and yet they felt it there, calling to them, perhaps, rousing them from sleep.
I moved slightly, and Jamie lifted his hand from my leg.
"Zucken Ruhe," he said softly,
tracing with a fingertip the damp mark he had left on my skin.
"What's that?" "That's what Stern called it. The wakefulness of the wee birds getting ready to leave on their long flight."
"Does it mean something in particular?"
"Aye. Ruhe is stillness, rest. And Zug is a journey of some sort. So Zucken Ruhe is a restlessness, the uneasiness before a long journey."
I rolled toward him, butting my forehead affectionately against his shoulder. I inhaled, in the style of one savouring the delicate aroma of a fine cigar.
"Udom?"
He raised his head and sniffed dubiously, wrinkling up his nose.
"Eau de chèvre, I think," he said, "though it might be something worse. Is there a French word for skunk, I wonder?"
"Le pieu," I suggested, giggling. The birds sang all night. Chapter 108. Tulloch Arzt, October 1772. Jamie nodded at something behind him, smiling.
"I see we've helped today."
Roger looked back to see Jemmy stumping along behind them, his small fair brow furrowed in fierce concentration, a fist-sized rock clutched to his chest with both hands. Roger wanted a laugh at the sight, but instead turned and squatted down, waiting for the boy to catch them up.
"Is that for the new hog pen, Rilaro?" he said.
Jemmy nodded solemnly. The morning was still cool, but the little boy's cheeks glowed with effort.
"Thank you," Roger said gravely.
He held out his hand.
"Shall I take it, then?"
Jemmy shook his head violently, heavy fringe flying.
"Me do."
"That's a long walk, Hilaru," Jamie said. "And your mother will miss you, no?"
"No."
"Granda's right, a valach. Mummy needs you," Roger said, reaching for the rock. "Here, let me take..."
"No!"
Jemmy clutched the rock protectively against his smock, mouth set in a stubborn line.
"But you can't," Jamie began.
"Come!"
"No, I said you must..."
Roger began.
"Come!"
"Now, look, lad..."
Both men began together, then stopped, looked at each other, and laughed.
"Where's Mummy, then?" Roger said, trying another tack. "Mummy will be worried about you, aye?"
The small red head shook in vehement negation.
"Claire said the woman meant to be quilting today," Jamie said to Roger. "Marsale's brought a pattern. They'll maybe have started the stitching of it."
He squatted down beside Roger, eye to eye with his grandson.
"Have you got away from your mother, then?"
The soft pink mouth, hitherto clamped tight, twitched, allowing a small giggle to escape.
"Thought so,"
Roger said in resignation. Come on, then, back to the house.
He stood up and swung the little boy up into his arms, rock and all.
No, no, no!
Jemmy stiffened in resistance, his feet digging painfully into Roger's belly as his body arched backward like a bow.
Me help! Me help!
Trying to make his own arguments heard through Jemmy's roars without shouting, while at the same time keeping the boy from falling backward onto his head, Roger didn't at first hear the cries from the direction of the house. When he finally resorted to clapping a hand over his offspring's wide-open mouth, though, feminine calls of Jemmy were clearly audible through the trees.
See, Mrs. Lizzie's looking for you,
Jamie said to his grandson, jerking a thumb toward the sound.
Not only Lizzie,
Roger said. More women's voices were echoing the chorus with increasing notes of annoyance.
Mum and Granny Claire and Granny Bug and Aunt Masali too, from the sounds of it. They don't sound very pleased with you, lad.
We'd best take him back then, Jamie said.
He looked at his grandson, not without sympathy.
Mind you'd like to get your bum smacked, laddie. Women dinna like it when you run off on them.
This threatening prospect caused Jemmy to drop his rock and wrap his arms and legs tightly round Roger.
Go with you, Daddy,
he said coaxingly.
But Mummy...
No, Mummy. Want Daddy?
Roger patted Jemmy's back, small but solid under his grubby smock. He was torn. This was the first time Jem had so definitely wanted him in preference to Bree, and he had to admit to a sneaking feeling of flattery. Even if his son's present partiality sprang as much from an urge to avoid punishment as from a desire for his company, Jem had wanted to come with him.
I suppose we could take him,
he said to Jamie, over Jem's head, now nestled trustingly against his collarbone.
Just for the morning. I could fetch him back at noon.
Oh, aye,
Jamie said. He smiled at his grandson, picked up the fallen stone and handed it back to him.
Building hog pens is proper man's work, aye? None of this prinking and yaffling the ladies are so fond of.
Speaking of yaffling...
Roger lifted his chin in the direction of the house, where the cries of Jemmy were now taking on a distinctly irritated tone tinged with panic.
We'd best tell them we have him.
I'll go.
Jamie dropped the rucksack off his shoulder with a sigh and raised one eyebrow at his grandson.
Mind, lad, you owe me. When women are in a fret, they'll take it out on the first man they see, whether he's to blame or not. Like enough I'll get my bum smacked.
He rolled his eyes but grinned at Jemmy, then turned and set off for the house at a trot. Jemmy giggled.
Smack Granda,
he called.
Hush, wee rascal.
Roger gave him a soft slap on the bottom and realised that Jem was wearing short breeks under his smock, but no clout under them. He swung the boy down onto his feet.
Do you need to go potty?
He asked automatically, falling into Brianna's peculiar idiom.
No,
Jem said, just as automatically, but with a reflexive kneading of his crotch that made his father take him by the arm, firmly steering him off the path and behind a convenient bush.
Come on. Let's have a try while we wait for Granda.
This ends Disc 45. The Fiery Cross, Disc 46.
It seemed rather a long time before Jamie reappeared, though the indignant cries of the searchers had been quickly stilled. If Jamie had got his bum smacked, Roger thought cynically, he appeared to have enjoyed it. A slight flush showed on the high cheekbones, and he wore a faint but definite air of satisfaction. This was explained at once, though, when Jamie produced a small bundle from inside his shirt and unwrapped a linen towel, revealing half a dozen fresh biscuits, still warm and dripping with melted butter and honey.
I think perhaps Mrs. Bug meant them for the quilting circle, he said, distributing the booty, but there was plenty of batter left in the bowl. I doubt they'll be missed.
If they are, I'll blame it on you,
Roger assured him, catching a dribble of warm honey that ran down his wrist. He wiped it off and sucked his finger, eyes closing momentarily in ecstasy.
What now, you'd give me up to the Inquisition?
Jamie's eyes creased into blue triangles of amusement as he wiped crumbs from his mouth.
And after I shared my plunder with you two,
There's gratitude.
Your reputation will stand it, Roger said wryly. Jem and I are persona non grata after what happened to our spice cake last week. But himself can do no wrong as far as Granny Bug is concerned. She wouldn't mind if you ate the entire contents of the pantry single-handed.
Jamie licked a smear of honey from the corner of his mouth with the smug complacency of a man permanently in Mrs. Bug's good books.
Well, that's as may be, he admitted. Still, if you expect to blame it on me, we'd best wipe a bit of the evidence off the laddie before we go home.
Jemmy had been addressing himself to his treat with single-minded concentration, with the result that his entire face gleamed with butter. Daubs of honey ran in amber trails down his smock, and what appeared to be several small globs of half-chewed biscuit were stuck in his hair.
"How in hell did you do that so fast?"
Roger demanded in amazement.
"Look what you've done to your shirt. Your mother will kill us both."
He took the towel and made an abortive attempt to wipe some of the mess off, but succeeded only in spreading it farther.
"Dunna fash," Jamie said tolerantly. "He'll be so covered with filth by the end of the day his mother will never notice a few crumbs extra. Watch out, lad!"
A quick grab saved half a biscuit that had broken off as the boy made an attempt to cram the last pastry into his mouth in a single gulp.
"Still,"
Jamie said, biting thoughtfully into the rescued biscuit half as he looked at his grandson.
"Perhaps we'll souse him in the creek a bit. We didn't want the pigs to smell the honey on him."
A faint qualm of unease went over Roger as he realised that Jamie was in fact not joking about the pigs. It was common to see or hear pigs in the wood nearby, rooting through the leaf mould under oaks and poplars, or grunting blissfully over a trove of chestnut mast. Food was plentiful at this season, and the pigs were no threat to grown men. A small boy, though, smelling of sweetness. You thought of pigs as only eating roots and nuts, but Roger had a vivid memory of the big white sow seen a few days before, with the naked blood-smeared tail of a possum dangling from her maw as she champed placidly away. A chunk of biscuit seemed to be stuck in his throat. He picked Jemmy up despite the stickiness, and tucked him giggling under one arm, so the little boy's arms and legs dangled in the air.
"Come on, then," Roger said, resigned. "Mummy won't like it a bit if you get eaten by a pig."
Fence poles lay piled near the stone pillar. Roger dug about until he found a splintered piece short enough for convenience, and used it to lever a big chunk of granite up far enough to get both hands under it. Squatting, he got it onto his thighs and very slowly stood up, his back straightening one vertebra at a time, fingers digging into the lichen-splotched surface with the effort of lifting. The rag tied round his head was drenched and perspiration was running down his face. He shook his head to flick the stinging sweat out of his eyes.
"Daddy? Daddy?"
Roger felt a sudden tug at his breeches, blinked sweat out of his eye, and planted his feet well apart to keep his balance without dropping the heavy rock. He tightened his grip and glanced down, annoyed.
"What, lad?"
Jemmy had tight hold of the cloth with both hands. He was looking toward the wood.
"Pig, Daddy," he whispered. "Pig, pig."
Roger glanced in the direction of the little boy's gaze and froze. It was a huge black boar, perhaps 8 feet away. The thing stood more than 3 feet at the shoulder and must weigh 200 pounds or more, with curving yellow tushes the length of Jemmy's forearm. It stood with lifted head, piggy snout moistly working as it snuffed the air for food or threat.
"Shit,"
Roger said involuntarily. Jemmy, who would normally have seized on any inadvertent vulgarity and trumpeted it gleefully, now merely clung tighter to his father's leg. Thoughts raced through Roger's mind like colliding freight cars. Would it attack if he moved? He had to move. The muscles of his arms were trembling under the strain. He'd splashed Jem with water. Did the boy still smell or look like something on the pig's menu? He picked one coherent thought out of the wreckage.
"Jem," he said, his voice very calm, "get behind me. Do it now."
he added with emphasis as the boar turned its head in their direction. It saw them. He could see the small dark eyes change focus. It took a few steps forward, its hooves absurdly small and dainty